KZSU FM Stanford, welcome to another edition of Hearsay Culture. My name is Dave Levine. I'm an associate professor at Elon University School of Law, as well as an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. Thank you for joining me today on the show. Today I'm excited to have on Ben O'Loughlin and Laura Rizal, co-authors of the book Strategic Narratives, Communication Power and the New World Order, with Alistair MacSkimmon, who is not joining us today on the show. In Strategic Narratives, both Laura and Ben take a close look at this question of really, and I'm going to ask them, but the storytelling in the world of international relations, specifically how narratives play a role in policymaking and what the importance of those narratives are in terms of the policy goals, but also in terms of communicating to different audiences. This is a topic that crosses a number of areas on Hearsay Culture that have been a focus. I mean, you can start, obviously, with internet law and policy, because the internet and as a medium of communication has, as we know, changed the game when it comes to how people communicate, how they consume information, and how they ultimately receive it and use it in their lives. But in Strategic Narratives, we're also taking a close look at the theory behind these communication structures, focusing on international relations. So another topic on Hearsay Culture that has been an increasing focus because of its import in intellectual property law and policy has been international relations. And increasingly, because that is where much of the action is on the IP policy side, and more specifically, because there isn't as much coverage of those issues in mainstream media, I've turned a lot of attention on Hearsay Culture in the last couple of years to international relations and policy. More and more, as SOPA and PIPA indicated, and other patent reform issues have moved towards the international arena, I've perceived a strong need amongst my listeners as well as the public generally to have a greater understanding of international relations and policy. And therefore, Strategic Narratives is a wonderful book to get into that direction as well. How do narratives work on the international stage where audiences not only cross geographic lines but also cross cultural boundaries? And so in Communication Power in a New World Order, we're going to be taking a close look at these issues from the perspective of two leading and very active communication law scholars, communication scholars, and in fact, occasionally, of course, because their policy area is touching on law. By way of very brief background, Ben O'Loughlin is a professor of international relations and co-director of the New Political Communication Unit at Royal Holloway University of London. He's also a co-editor of the journal Media, War, and Conflict. Laura Rizal is my colleague at Elon University. She's a professor of political science at Elon and a visiting professor of public policy at Duke. She's president of the Information Technology and Politics section of the American Political Science Association, and along with Ben is a co-editor of the journal Media, War, and Conflict. They are joining us via Skype today. Ben joining us from a hotel in New York, and Laura from her Elon office down the road from me in Greensboro. We are recording today on May 4th, 2014. And Laura and Ben, thank you so much for joining us today on Hearsay Culture.
Thank you, Dave.
Thanks, Dave.
So let's start off, and Laura, I guess I'll start with you, and then I'll go to Ben. Tell us a bit more about your background and why you co-wrote Strategic Narratives.
Yes. Well, I am a political scientist and actually trained at Stanford. My interest in political science always came from an underlying interest in political communication. I studied Soviet media as an undergraduate at Emory University and worked for the Carter Center in the 1980s in a research program on the transitioning Soviet media system. My co-authors, Ben and Alistair, were working on this idea of strategic narratives, and I thought I might be interested as well, and especially because I had spent some time looking at how political leaders use media to explain policy. I wrote a book called Media and the Politics of Failure, in which I analyzed how political leaders in the U.S. explained failure in Vietnam and how Soviet leaders explained failure in Afghanistan. And I was thrilled to begin thinking about strategic narratives with these two colleagues and with many more who heard our conference papers and contributed really great ideas. In particular, I guess, I was convinced that international relations scholars did not think enough about how narratives shape the world that we take for granted. And I thought that understanding how strategic narratives worked would be crucial to understanding a change in the international system from a bipolar system, a Cold War system, to, I guess, something else. The book and our collaboration is absolutely about understanding communication and power.
Ben?
Yeah, I mean, just to follow up on Laura there, really. I mean, within international relations, we were getting told that the internet was changing everything, and there were, you know, participatory media, Web 2.0 in the mid sort of 2000s, late 2000s, that, you know, the people were going to get connected, and this was going to change how power functions. So people like Manuel Castells were writing about this and gaining a lot of prominence. But at the same time, we had a sense that those people either studying international relations or actual people running foreign policy in different countries didn't really have a grip on how the new media ecology, as we call it, was changing how power functions. So we thought that the idea of narratives was a great way in, because it kind of gets at the kind of work that foreign policy makers are trying to do to explain how the world is changing in order to get legitimacy for what they're trying to do, to get their publics at home and abroad behind them. So basically we were able to kind of bring together the idea of narrative, of using narratives strategically, and all within, you know, within the media ecology. How does that constrain or enable different actors around the world to use these narratives to win consent for what they want to do?
So Ben, let me start with you, and I want to define some terms, but before I even do that, something you just said occurs to me as a good way to frame this discussion. And I always had kind of a pithy way to ask the question, but, you know, what's with all this explaining? And I guess what I mean is that the notion that policymakers have to explain what they're doing to the public, is not necessarily one that is as deep, in terms of a history as we might think. And perhaps, you know, to frame our discussion, I'm going to ask you to both you and Laura to define, phrases like strategic narratives in a moment, but let's start there. I mean, you have any reaction to that? I mean, you know, the notion of explaining, what you're doing, right, and explaining your activities is one that undergirds your book. What's your reaction to that as a motivating factor for communication generally?
Well, that's a great question. Something happened in the kind of early 2000s, particularly around the Iraq War, where the kind of Bush presidency was going into Iraq, going into other places, and there was resistance both in those countries and from public opinion around the world. And the neo-realist or neo-conservative American scholar Robert Kagan, very prominent at the time, wrote a book saying, hang on, we can't just go around doing what we want. We've got to explain what we're doing. Otherwise, we're not legitimate. And the idea that, like, the Washington DC kind of foreign policy circuit was suddenly thinking, oh, we can't just do what we want. We've got to explain it. The fact that they had to even have a conversation about that was remarkable. So from that point onwards, it's been pretty obvious that in the US, but also, you know, in Western Europe and China, that countries' leaders are desperately trying to explain what they're doing, because what they're doing is visible because of global media, because of, you know, every sort of great power, big country at the moment has its 24/7 TV station. Publics around the world are able to see what are the effects of their own country's policies or what America's policies are doing. And that means that policymakers became more accountable. So this is why I think over the last 10 years there's been this urge to explain.
Laura, let's turn to the title of your book, and again, to frame our discussion. And of course, you can respond to that previous question as well, if you like, or add anything to Ben's response. But what do you mean by the phrase of strategic narratives?
So strategic narratives for us are a means for political actors to construct a shared meaning of the past, present, and future of international politics in order to shape the behavior of domestic and international actors. So there are two parts here. Narratives, of course, and many scholars have studied narratives. And the way stories are told. You can think, for example, back to Aristotle's Poetics. But we are really focused on that strategic aspect. So how are political actors attempting to use narratives in order to shape the behavior of other actors in the system? And in part, that ties back to your question about why political actors need to explain anything at all. Of course, we know that, certainly from the work of Alexander George, that policy legitimacy has always been quite important, because political leaders are constrained by domestic publics, for example, their constituents. But also, as the new media ecology has shaped communication in a new way, political leaders are compelled to, or forced to, explain even more because there are other stories out there. Part of what we do in the book, in terms of looking at strategic narratives, is focus on contestation about those narratives and how that fits into the strategy of leaders.
So we've got this notion of narratives, and I'm not sure. Maybe I simplified it. Maybe I didn't. In talking about it from the framework of storytelling, because in your book, you spend a good amount of time, I think, giving a lot of context to these theoretical issues, which we're going to talk about. In my understanding of your meaning of strategic narratives, there's two other words. Or ideas that become very important. So Ben, maybe I'll ask you. I mean, can you define for us what frames and discourses are, and what their differences are, and how they relate to your focus on strategic narratives?
Okay, so by frames in the book, we mean ways in which a political actor or a journalist or whoever we're talking about selects a certain aspect of something that is happening at that moment or in the past. So you could frame a protest that's going on in Ukraine or some military action by showing some bits and excluding others. So frames are static. They show a glimpse or a snapshot of a moment. So they're not about moving through time. They don't tell you what's going to happen next, although you can always make guesses. But this is one way in which frames are very different to narratives. Narratives have this sense of moving from the past through the present to the future, from the beginning through the middle to the end, whereas frames are the snapshot of the moment. And then discourses, by discourses we mean these kind of long-term bodies of knowledge, probably, things like law, medicine, even political science, I'm not quite sure Laura can say more on that, that, again, they don't have this kind of sense of movement through time. Law is it doesn't change that often, and when it does, it's a big deal. Or medicine, it changes incrementally. So those, foreign policy makers who are trying to craft narratives, they use frames. They definitely do framing, because they will frame particular characters. They'll frame their enemy. They'll frame an event. But they then have to put those into sequences to form a narrative, in order to create some expectations of what should happen next. Equally, those leaders will draw on discourses. They'll draw on international law, or they'll draw on science if it's climate policy that they're trying to create a narrative about. But those frames and those discourses are kind of the material that actors draw on strategically to craft a compelling narrative.
So, Laura, what if we're going to, and if you want to, as Ben alluded to, if you want to add something from the political science perspective, feel free. Otherwise, the classic academic question, your thesis.
Yes. So, well, we make a number of particular arguments in the book, and really I think that our contribution comes from first we argue that narratives are central to human relations, that they shape our world and constrain our behavior. There is a significant amount of work on how human beings use narratives to understand the world. Second, we argue that political actors attempt to use these narratives strategically. So they think about how narratives will best allow them to reach political goals. And that third, our communication environment fundamentally affects how these narratives are communicated and flow, and with what effects. In addition, I think what we do is we really elaborate on what we believe narratives to be, what they are, how actors use them, and I'll give you an example. So, for example, people can say, okay, narratives, what do you mean? And we often point to narratives about particular policies or issues. So how would a political leader attempt to legitimize a policy by using a particular narrative? We go, I think, well beyond just looking at policy or issue narratives. We also point out and think that it's really important to understand that there are what we call identity narratives, which are not narratives about policy per se, but narratives about what the state or any other political actor thinks itself to be. And so what is the narrative, for example, of the United States? How is the United States identified, or how is its identity constructed in a narrative form? What is its autobiography, if you will? And we also point out that in addition to those policy or issue narratives and identity narratives, that it is important to look at system narratives. And by system narratives, we mean narratives that explain, describe, set out the contours of the international system itself. So that means, for example, you might have a system narrative that looks at the international system as bipolar, as a bipolar system or a multipolar system. And one of the things that really struck us as we got into writing this and sort of propelled our interest in the subject to begin with was the fact that we were looking at a transition from a bipolar system to something else. And there is a narrative contestation in the world today about what the international system is and will be in the future.
We're chatting with Ben McLaughlin and Laura Rizel on KZSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, co-authors of the book Strategic Narratives, Communication Power, and the New World Order. You know, Laura, as you mentioned that, and Ben, I'll ask you, you know, we've got a lot of examples of these issues arising post September 11th. I'm curious, and this is part of this kind of historic question I'm asking, but, you know, are the antecedents of these concerns directly tied to the internet, or is the internet something that has kind of exacerbated the issues? And of course, you know, Hearsay Culture focused on technology, we draw heavily there, so I'm not trying to load the dice for a particular answer. I'm curious, you know, prior to 2001, are we seeing this issue taking form?
Well, I mean, strategic narratives can go, we can find them if we go back a long way. So Laura has written about the role of kind of George Kennan at the beginning of the Cold War, setting out a narrative of, you know, how world order was going to be. But we definitely think that something has been going on in the last decade, and this is tied into the internet. So it's kind of, there's a lot of talk about sort of public diplomacy 2.0, about citizen diplomacy, and the idea that we the people, once we're connected, we can be players in international events and around international events. So the question is, who is doing strategic narrative? Who is narrating? And is it the case that when we go on Twitter or on Facebook and talk about international affairs, we're contributing to strategic narratives? So this is something that we're trying to explain and kind of give an account of, because policymakers are extremely anxious about this. For centuries, they have had a quasi-monopoly on who gets to tell the big stories about where the world is headed in international affairs. And suddenly, when something is happening in Syria or Ukraine, that people can go on Twitter and contest what John Kerry is saying, or contest what Vladimir Putin is saying. This is completely new. This has never been able to happen before. And so policymakers are under a lot of pressure about how, have been for the last decade, how best to deal with this. So we're interested in how this is happening. And it's the key point, I think, that, or one of the key points that we want to make about this is, it's not just that, that citizens or publics or users are able to go online and narrate, but because of that, there is an intense competition among the great powers, China and America and Europe, to define what the internet is. Because if you can define what the internet is and how it works, so that some voices get heard or some voices don't get heard, then you will decide in advance who's going to win the argument. So China, for example, with its model of the internet, with, you know, much more bounded, much more constrained, much more regulated, arguably, is putting forth a version of the internet because that's what it thinks will help it kind of control its public opinion back home. Whereas the US and maybe the UK have a much more open, liberal approach to what the internet should be, because they think that that will benefit their national interests. So not only will more voices get heard pushing agendas that the US or the UK or France or Germany might favour more, but also that American companies will do better and American universities will do better, that a more open world will benefit America. So it's this kind of two-level game being played here between, who can narrate on the internet, but whose narrative of the internet will win? Who will get to shape how the internet is?
So Laura, playing off what Ben just said, and a few things there, but I'll start with George Kennan's work, because as I was reading through this, and something I've thought a lot about is how public diplomacy and the theory of public diplomacy applies given the internet today. So I'll kind of ask you that open-ended question, which is your thesis an updating of sorts of public diplomacy theory that's gone back for a while, or is it something wholly different? What's the interplay here between public diplomacy and Kennan, roughly aligned, and strategic narratives as you define them?
Right. So I guess the way I'll approach that is by first talking just a little bit about how we see Kennan and the way we use his experience and his actions in the immediate post-World War II period in shaping the Cold War sort of international structure, in setting out a narrative about bipolar international system. It is really interesting to look back at the way a combination of domestic political context and immediate political needs came together with Kennan and others' views of the international system. And the domestic political imperatives of the immediate post-war period pushed some of Kennan's ideas even further than he would have liked. But there was a question of trying to get policies implemented in an America that was weary of war, and did not necessarily want to spend a lot of money helping Europe, for example. So the case had to be made, the narrative had to be constructed for the American public to justify a different kind of world. So we looked at this and could disentangle sort of the processes of constructing that narrative. And then when you look at it, that kind of process today, as Ben said, the technology, the role of the internet and communication changes the dynamics there so significantly. Now, the U.S. has focused, and other countries around the world, of course, have focused on what we now call public, you know, public diplomacy, that somehow we need to, or these governments need to, focus on publics abroad with particular narratives in order for those publics to then influence their own governments, and influence and have a role in international relations. And this is much more difficult today. And you have the technology, sort of the spread of participatory media and communication power brings those people into international relations as an actor to be courted, whose views should be engaged with. And there really isn't the option not to engage, because people will engage themselves anyway. And so on the one hand, it's much more difficult for policymakers or political actors to do public diplomacy. However, they don't have sort of the luxury of not doing public diplomacy.
Ben, is there and again, I'm going back and forth here, because I think there's a tremendous amount of material here to dig into. You know, and it struck me as reading your book that, you know, a lot of what most, I think, of what you're saying can apply not just at the international level, but at the domestic level. And that's not just because of the two-level game theory, which for those that aren't familiar, and simplifying it greatly, says that communication in the international sphere serves both a function at the international level, dealing with diplomatic and other counterparts, but also the story plays a role at the domestic level for those negotiators, so they have to thread this very fine needle. But my question, therefore, is whether what you're writing about and the issues you're raising are unique to international relations, or that the lessons here and the stories you're telling can apply for, let's say, a member of Congress in the United States who's simultaneously addressing not just colleagues in Congress, but also their own constituents, or even you know, at a more local level than that. So what's unique about international relations here, Ben, such that strategic narratives become challenging?
What's unique, Dave, I think, is the ambition. It's, you know, if you're George Kennan and you're coming up with a strategic narrative, that defined world order for, you know, many, many decades. And, you know, a lot happened because of that. So we're talking about narratives that define how the world will be. You know, this is, you know, these are mega narratives. So although a member of Congress in the US can, you know, have an awful lot of say over what happens domestically, it's not kind of with the same ambition, as I said. So the basic principles might be the same, in that you're trying to court your, you know, your own constituency. So in domestic politics, that would be literally, you know, your district, or your county. And then also you're aware that you want to maybe get national public opinion on your side, if you think that's going to help in some way. Just as in international relations, you want to keep your domestic public happy, but it's also useful if some of global public opinion is on your side. And then also you want, whether you're operating within domestic politics or in international relations, you're trying to stitch together events into some kind of sequence that supports your policies. So you want to show that the problems that you're facing and the opportunities available, that you're the person who can lead your public towards whatever the happy ending is that you want. So that principle is the same at the domestic or the international level, but But our argument is that once you get to the international level and you're setting, you're trying to create an understanding about how the future of world order is going to be. Is it going to be multipolar, bipolar? The consequences of this are huge. So, for example, in the last kind of 5-10 years, we've had narratives about the rise of the BRICS and the rise of the rest. And these are narratives about how the next 30 to 50 years of world politics are going to be. These are huge narratives, and the implications we saw over the last decade, the United States, for example, responding to the idea of the rise of China as part of the rise of the BRICS by having the pivot to Asia. So the whole of US foreign policy was altered because it was responding to this narrative about how, you know, one country is rising, and this creates a new obstacle or problem that might stop the US kind of reaching its happy ending in its narrative. So just the scale and the kind of sense of world historic change is what we're trying to get at.
We're chatting with Ben McLaughlin and Laura Rizel, co-authors of the book Strategic Narratives, Communication Power and the New World Order, on KCSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture. For those of you that listen to Hearsay Culture regularly, you know it's on KCSU, which is a nonprofit, non-commercial radio station at Stanford University that requires donations from listeners like you to continue its diverse programming. You have a couple of ways you can make a donation to KZSU. You can email our underwriting department at underwriting@kzsu.stanford.edu, or you can go to our webpage and click on Donate to KZSU. Regardless, I hope that you continue to listen to the station. So, Laura, you know, the issues that of policymakers receiving narratives themselves as opposed to the public, I think, is an interesting one. Right? As we think about these stories and telling these narratives and creating these narratives for multiple audiences, you know, it raises the very issues that Ben and you have written about with regard to, you know, the inundation of content, if you will, that the public receives. But my question really is for policymakers themselves, these conversations that are happening, as you point out, as you talk about the Abu Ghraib scenario and WikiLeaks, are private conversations, in a sense, that are happening publicly in a very real sense. So how do policymakers receive these narratives as opposed to the public at large?
Yeah, I think that's a really good question, Dave. Policymakers, it's interesting. They receive narratives within a specific political environment or context that is often very different from the public at large. So that's on the one hand. On the other, there are similarities in the way they receive narratives from the media, for example. So if we just look at the differences sort of for policymakers in that political context in which they live, I mean, this highlights the role of interests, especially moneyed interests, for example, in the United States, and the importance of understanding multiple audiences, because political leaders have to take into account constituent opinions, to be sure, but also contributors' opinions as well, and others who would try to have an effect on them. So when they're receiving narratives, or sort of how they sort of understand narratives, is in part based on who these narratives are coming from and the credibility of the sources. And that credibility is enmeshed in this political context. So policymakers, at least in democracies, are also embedded in electoral competition, and this affects how policymakers receive narratives. So I would say that political context in which policymakers find themselves is key to understanding their reception of narratives. The public at large, and I guess we have to ask, is there a public anymore? Mm-hmm. Because of the fragmentation of audiences as a result of our new media ecology, that notion of a public is questionable or at least vastly different. And the public now can be many publics that are receiving or receiving narratives via different media. So people have their, or groups within the public have their own preferred set of media sort of outlets from which they will get information. And we know that narratives in different media can be extremely different. So the fragmentation of the audience, I think, is key to understanding public reception of the narratives. You might want to add some, Ben.
Yeah, I was about to say, Ben, you want to add to that?
Yeah, just one thing, really. It's policymakers are people, too. And when you see them respond to narratives or receive narratives, they receive them with their families at home sometimes. Or they receive them just by, you know, looking on their tablet and seeing a news site. They're not always kind of in electoral mode. So with the Abu Ghraib pictures, there's been a lot of kind of writing now, because it's been a while, about how US congressmen first saw the pictures and how they were shocked and disgusted and moved in different ways. And okay, there might have been about 10 minutes, and then there was that, right, what does this mean politically? But at the very moment of reception, there was still that kind of visceral human element. So I think this is one of the great kind of unexplored areas in foreign policy at the moment is how foreign policymakers compared to, you know, their families or to the public at large are receiving this, because you'd think, you know, we know about the psychology of some past presidents, we know how idiosyncratic they can be, and so it might be that we have a kind of very systematic explanation of what narratives do, but it might also quite often depend on the character and personality of the individual policymakers.
And I could just add, jump in there, mm-hmm. because you made me think about something, Ben, was that, you know, it also points to, especially bringing up, say, Abu Ghraib, that narratives can be almost activated by small things, by, say, images or memes or other types of communication. And that kind of visuality is extremely important to emotional reactions.
You know, and it ties in, you know, as I was thinking through these examples, Laura, you know, we've got a situation where in both the cases of Abu Ghraib and WikiLeaks and others, we are talking, and of course WikiLeaks says this, about leaked information, right? Part of the challenge, it seems, of creating a strategic narrative today is the lack of control over information. And I want to ask Ben about control of infrastructure particularly, but before I ask Ben that question, I kind of want to ask you the question at that top level, which will tie into the discussion of transparency that we'll have in a few minutes. But with regard to leaks, I mean, how does one today negotiate a world of strategic narratives with you know the proverbial world eye on you and leaks to contend with? What's your reaction to that challenge?
Well, I think you've hit on a really important point that sort of characterizes or highlights, you know, part of our argument, which is that this new media ecology, the internet, and all of the other sort of technological changes, changes the dynamic. And leaks is just one sort of example there. So these changes change the reach of communication technology, increases transparency, and then also sort of it can distort time horizons and sort of bring things out of the shadows that perhaps policymakers never thought they would have to deal with. So that absolutely goes to the heart of our argument about what new communication technology does. Now, I think it's also interesting, though, that the question of who has information and who should have information is central to the development of all of these types of narratives that we've talked about, the system, the identity, and the issue narratives. For example, an international narrative that includes internet freedom may align with these identity narratives in the U.S. and the EU that Ben said a little bit about, but actions such as Abu Ghraib or other kinds of leaks, revelations such as those exposed by WikiLeaks, they call into question those system and identity narratives and can significantly damage, say, U.S. credibility. So that makes it very important, especially for those states that strategically project a system narrative about openness and transparency, to also pursue policies that are in accord with those very narratives.
Ben, with that in mind, this control of infrastructure issue, of course, is a huge one. It's one that, again, with regard to these narratives, of course, became, a critical issue as infrastructure was shut down in the Arab Spring. And there's been a lot of writing, of course, about the impact on the Internet. But my question for you is really how, from the international stage perspective, control of infrastructure plays a role, particularly between regimes that are able to harness new technology and use it. Admittedly, there are fewer of those, and those that can't. So what's your reaction to this control of infrastructure question?
I think one of the things we've seen happening with states that can harness public opinion is that once you get the public talking, and often they'll talk anyway, so there's not much you can do about that, but publics have the same kind of political imagination as many policymakers. They see the world through the lens of national interest. So if you can get your public talking about whatever is the crisis event in the world, chances are they will talk in a way that will kind of elevate the interests of your own kind of perspective or national interest, and will do down your rivals. So we see this I'll just sneak a British example into this, but we have this kind of ongoing conflict with Argentina over the status of the Malvinas or Falkland Islands. And here there was an anniversary about a year ago where the Argentine sort of public political elite were extremely pleased because their citizens and some of their journalists started producing these viral videos about how the islands were really belong to the Argentinians, and that Britain should leave that. And the political elite didn't have to do anything. So then the British, the Foreign Office got very upset about this because the Argentine public was poking fun at them, but also disputing their land rights. Before the Foreign Office could really respond, as equivalent as your State Department, it turned out that lots of kind of young media savvy people in London and elsewhere were coming up with their kind of spoofs of the Argentinian videos. So you kind of had this turf war between citizens, users in Argentina and in Britain over a matter of sovereignty and, high politics and war not that long ago. So it was the idea that publics will kind of subvert or do crazy things or undermine your national interest if you get them to take part in public diplomacy. It doesn't seem to be borne out with what's happening. I mean, China's had it's become a classic case now in international relations where China would probably the Chinese elite is not that aggressive all the time towards Japan, but its users online within China are extremely nationalistic and against Japan at any opportunity. So again, we find that citizens, because they've kind of grown up with the imagination of the nation state that they've been raised and educated within, once they get into the information infrastructure, they do what states would have done anyway, which might be quite disappointing for those who thought that participatory media might lead to a different kind of politics. it doesn't seem to be the way. So that's the first point. And the second point is one I've kind of made already, but it's about, well, who controls the internet in the first place is going to control whose stories get out there. So if we're talking about the information infrastructure, then all of the battles, the efforts that the United States is going in to create a kind of multi-stakeholder internet governance that would kind of involve as much of the world as possible, but make sure it kind of becomes the template that the United States would prefer. That's not just about commercial interests. That's about creating a kind of global public sphere along the lines that the United States would prefer, because that means that more pro-US voices will get heard over the next 10, 20 years. So this is about creating legitimacy in the long term. So this again goes back to why our focus is international relations, because it's these long games that are being played. So strategic narratives about information infrastructure are extremely important.
We're chatting with Ben O'Loughlin and Laura Rizel on KJSU-FM Stanford and Hearsay Culture, co-authors of the book Strategic Narratives, Communication Power in a New World Order, with Alistair Miskimmon, who is not joining us today. Ben and Laura, we're now well into what I call the unfair portion of the show. This is when I start asking you questions that you can't answer adequately in the time that you have left, and then I continue to ask them. So it's kind of a rough justice that goes on here at this point of the show, where I think I've made friends and then I start losing them. But nonetheless, we'll continue going. So Laura, we've gone around this issue of transparency. And it's a hot topic of the day. I'm going to spare you having to define it per se, unless you'd like to, in your own way. But it seems everyone has their own definition. But I can ask you a more concrete question, which is really, do you have a way or a principled way, from your perspective of assessing this key question that you pose early on in the book and that we've already alluded to, but maybe haven't answered, as to on who should have what information, and when they should have it. So, this is obviously a hot topic, both from a theoretical perspective and from a practical perspective, as I mentioned in the introduction, with the late round negotiations going on in the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement, and then the early round negotiations of TTIP between the U.S. and EU. So I'm not necessarily asking the question from the perspective of those agreements, but more from a broader perspective. Is there a principled way to square your theory of strategic narratives with that core question of who should have access to what information when?
Well, what I'm going to do, Dave, is turn it around a little bit.
Okay.
And say that the question and the way you ask that question point absolutely to the importance of understanding strategic narrative.
Mm-hmm.
Because what we need to do, and I think all participants in this conversation about transparency and international dialogue and discussions about issues related to transparency and technology and governance, all of those participants and all of the tech folks who are involved in developing technology have to recognize that they are engaging in the construction of narratives about this very thing, and that this is about power and communication. And to be thoughtful and measured, I think, in realizing how much their actions may shape the future. So I guess what I'm doing is sort of turning it around a little bit and saying, I think that all of the players and the actors must recognize that they are engaged in narrative construction, and that everyone else is too.
Ben, do you want to add anything on that point?
I'd point to the. I'm not the first person to say this, but we mentioned information literacy, media literacy, and if things are going to be more transparent and if there is going to be more leakage, it's a question of who knows how to do what with it. because there's no point having information if you don't know what it means or how it's valuable or what you can do with it. So the classic example again is WikiLeaks, where it was just data until for most of the public, until the New York Times and the Guardian and their kind of alliance of progressive newspapers turned it into a story that people could understand. So there might be, you know, huge databases of really politically salient information out there, but who has the kind of literacy to make sense of that? And at the moment, it's the role of mainstream media in deciding what is salient cannot be overlooked. So it's great that, you know, there are information freedom advocates out there, but the bottom line is, who knows what to do with that if they make it happen?
So we have about 2 minutes left. I'm actually going to ask both Ben and Laura the same question here. Your book, I think, is very valuable both for policymakers as well as for academics and researchers. And I'm curious to ask you, what I think is the harder question, although you may disagree. I normally ask this question at the beginning of interviews, but I actually didn't want to box you in that way, and I'd rather ask you at the end, which is, if a policymaker is picking up this book and trying to figure out what to take away from it to do their jobs, right? And I guess, Ben, I'll start with you and ask this. What would be the one, from a policy-making takeaway, that you'd want policymakers at the international level to take from your book?
Well, it's hilarious that you ask, because I've just been advising the British government on this.
Oh, great. Oh, yeah.
there's a report, the Soft Power report from the British Parliament that came out about a month ago, which I should have let you know about, really. But what we've advised is above all, this is the British case, so it would be slightly different for the strategic narrative of America or
right.
Brazil, China,
right.
Is to have to be pushing your narrative in a way that, again, doesn't box you in. It's got to be a narrative that's a little bit open, because if we're talking about creating a narrative that is going to kind of move the world forward together and create alliances and keep institutions running, you don't want to have a very narrow, fixed narrative. You've got to have a little bit of give. So the strategic narrative that Britain is kind of thinking through at the moment is, you know, we've got Scotland, Wales, we're part of Europe, we've got Northern Ireland, we've got quite a complex identity. So the idea of having a single fixed narrative just wouldn't work, even if we could agree on what it might be. So the task for states' leaders is coming up with a narrative that expresses their identity and their history, but that can also allow them to forge alliances and kind of build a shared future. I know that might sound a little bit idealistic, but that is a technical operation that governments are trying to work on right now.
Laura?
Yeah, I would tie in a little bit to that and say that if there was one thing that I think that policymakers should pay attention to, is that a short-sighted focus on policy or issue narratives in the short term can undermine broader system narratives. So that a quick fix policy, maybe thinking that surveillance policies might work to increase security, for example, a quick fix policy may in fact undermine broader system narratives about that you want to promote in the international system, and that will in fact enhance security down the road.
Ben O'Loughlin, Laura Rizel, co-authors of the book Strategic Narratives, Communication, Power, and the New World Order, published by Routledge. Thank you both for joining us in Hearsay Culture. There's so much more we could talk about. My next question would have been about stakeholders, but we'll leave that for another day, because God knows this issue is not going away, but I think that your book helps us get a real handle on thinking it through. So thank you for joining us today on Hearsay Culture. For educating my audience, I invite both of you back on the show to continue the discussion.
Thanks, Dave.
Thank you very much.
So there's several guests coming up on Hearsay Culture that I want to mention up front, those that are both going to be coming up near and far. Coming up next week, Larry Downs, author of Big Bang Disruption on Disruptive Technology and Business Strategies. Following that, Professor Evan Selinger of the Rochester Institute of Technology on Technology and Human Experience. Ryan Kalo of the University of Washington School of Law and Woody Hartzog of Cumberland School of Law on Robotics Law. And then closing out this quarter, Nabiha Syed of Levine, Sullivan, Koch, and Schultz LLP on drone technology and freedom of information. As always, there are a number of ways to listen to Hearsay Culture. You can listen to Hearsay Culture Wednesdays at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KZSU-FM Stanford. You can also get the show by going to hearsayculture.com, where you can get all 200-plus previous shows as well as the upcoming schedule, by going to the Center for Internet and Society's webpage at cyberlaw.stanford.edu, where you can also get all those shows and also other events going on at CIS, or by going to the iTunes page for the Center for Internet Society and subscribing there. As always, I welcome your comments, suggestions, and feedback at dave@hearsayculture.com. So thank you for joining me today on the show. Please stay tuned to KZSU for more diverse programming, and have a great day.